any other.
Say in rural. And I understand the problem with the federal law that we're up against, but I'm just telling you how I see things, and I just wanted to see what your response would be in just using that as an example of some of the inequities by passing something like this. And I'm no lawyer either, so I truly do want people who are truly subsistence hunters and fishermen to be treated equally. And if they have a right to it, they should deserve that right, no matter where they are or who they are or whatever. If they have that need, that's what you're talking about, their livelihood, and we cannot deny that. And there, you know, I'm just giving you one example. How do you take care of that particular situation? I mean, this is 10 to 20 families, and I assume you know where Clinton is at. If not, you haven't, you know, if you visited it. So I just wanted to give you that as something of food of thought.
Okay, I'll try to give a response as best as I can.
Yeah.
I feel that each community that is designated as a community should have that, you know, right to, especially subsistence, you know, villages like this, should have that right to be guided individually rather than because of their municipality, as, you know, as closely associated with Anchorage. And I feel that because Klutna is a village in itself, it should have its own special identity rather than being caught up with the municipality.
But with this thing, from my interpretation, with this thing, it excludes them entirely because they're not in a rural setting. They're within the boundaries of the municipality of Anchorage. And you're talking about people who've been there, been there for years. I mean, generation after generation. You know, those are one of my concerns. I just wanted to see what kind of response I would get out of you. Just pointing out that one.
My response is that the community of Klutna should be looked at individually rather than as a part of the municipality of Anchorage, because that is a community with 25 subsistence users. So that should be looked at, you know, as an individual village.
But if you see with this thing here, I think they'd be excluded. But that's just one example.
I think we want to try to zero in on the legislation here rather than get too far afield in specific examples, because we can go on all night here, and I want to try to get through as much of this as I can, Representative Mark.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if we're going to have the Department of Law here tomorrow, because I think that might be a question better asked than Sam.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to get a response. I don't tend to keep this thing going on and on, but I'm just telling where I'm trying to get at, and that's to come up with something that could at least satisfy most everybody.
Representative Phillips, we did have a place on the agenda for yourself, and I think you were going during that time, but maybe when we get done here, would you still be willing to give the committee some of your thoughts?
Well, I can do it tomorrow. Kurt just mentioned we'll have the opportunity to speak, so I'll speak then on the bill itself.
On tomorrow?
Yeah.
Is that what we...
As far as the bills are concerned.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, okay.
We'll move on. Are there additional comments or questions for Mr. Silas or Mr. Wallery? If not, thank you very much. Appreciate your comment. Next, I'd like to call the Association of Village Council Presidents, Mr. Sky Starkey. Welcome to our committee, Mr. Starkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm going to keep my comments real brief. The Association of Village Council Presidents represents 56 Native villages out in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. That's the area of Alaska which is probably the most dependent upon subsistence. I just want to make some comments about some of the people that have preceded me and respond to some of the things and that they've said and some of the comments that I've heard members of the committee say. To begin with, Mr. Ross does not represent any of the Native people or Native views of any of the villages that I represent. Certainly, he found a couple of Native people in Anchorage and got them on as clients, but that doesn't qualify him as representing at least any big segment of the Native population. Certainly, Mr. Ross comes across as a person who wants to protect subsistence rights, but the fact of the matter is that he had a chance to argue. The McDowell case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court struck out the rural definition and sent it to the Superior Court to decide whether or not we had a subsistence law that protected all Alaskans. That was the very question and the very issue in that case. And Mr. Ross and his firm argued that there was no subsistence law. That simply, they did not want a subsistence priority, and there was no subsistence law. So for them to get up here and to profess to protect subsistence rights is certainly not consistent with what they argued in court. Fortunately, the court found that they were wrong. There's a lot of talk about protecting subsistence uses, but that doesn't make subsistence users feel very good or secure, because no one has come up with any firm and material proposition to protect those rights. I've seen absolutely nothing on the table that is concrete that would protect those rights. All people are doing is asking you to delay a decision for some hypothetical plan. But what happens in the meantime to subsistence users? Certainly, there's a way to pass a constitutional amendment that would allow for all kinds of creative solutions, and there are some out there. And it may not be the rural constitutional amendment, but there are certainly ways to pass a constitutional amendment that's broader in scope and could be the pathway to some of these creative solutions. And I feel confident there'll be some before this committee at when the time comes to consider specific legislation. Finally, to give the AVCP's perspective on Representative Phillips' dilemma, certainly it should never be, it should be clear that people out in our region don't feel selfish about their right to subsist. There was a lot of talk about a Native preference and things like that before, but the genesis of that thought was to protect, they wanted to ensure their right to subsist. It wasn't to be selfish and to deny other people that right to subsist. And when this decision came down that all Alaskans would be open to subsistence use, the Association of Village Councils did not see that as any threat to their subsistence rights. So if this legislature chooses to pass a constitutional amendment that gives it the authority at some future date to expand subsistence protection and take care of problems like Representative Phillips points out, AVCP would support that. And with that, I'll conclude my comments.
Any comments or questions of Mr. Starkey? Representative Sharp.
Thank you. Starkey, last comment there as far as expanding and as far as your last comment on the possibility of future expansion of subsistence right, would you envision that being a second tier priority that would not be on the same priority level as rural preference initially we envisioned setting up?
Well, I'm going to give you my vision of what theoretically happens now that we have a subsistence law that's expansive, an all Alaskan subsistence law that Judge Cutler's decision would lead to. Theoretically, you would have the class of subsistence users expanded so that people can harvest those resources, more people can harvest the resource. Then you come to a situation like, for example, Upper Kuskokwim moose. Now, there aren't enough moose there for even subsistence users on the YK Delta. There's not enough moose for lower river people to go up and harvest moose from the upper river villages. In a situation like that, I would assume, and to be consistent with ANILCA, you would keep the Tier 2 in there. And that allows those people that are closest to the resource and most dependent on the resource to harvest that, the resource. So I would I would assume that if the law continues to operate anywhere close to as it does now, that the local people who are most dependent on the resource would continue to be protected in times of severe shortage. When there's enough resource for all people to harvest, then there wouldn't be that problem. And certainly in almost all subsistence cases, on all hunts and harvests, there aren't shortages of resources. It's just in a few places in the state with a few stocks of fish and game that there are these shortages.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Thank you, Mr. Starkey. Appreciate your comments. Next, I'd like to hear from AFN. And if you would please identify yourself for the record, Julie.
Yes, good evening. My name is Julie Kitka, and I'm the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. And with me today is John Shively, who chairs our legislative committee. I'll keep my comments very short because I know that you're looking at recessing very shortly. And we also had the opportunity to talk with many of you at your work session earlier last week. I do want to tell you of a couple new developments since then and give you some of our views. I guess the one new development as of today, you all read in the paper and Mr. Ross told you earlier that they have filed suit in federal court to try to overturn Title VIII on federal constitutional grounds. They filed that on Friday. We have reluctantly had to join in there today on the side of the federal government side on that to try to protect our interests in that case as that goes forward. So I just wanted to let you know that that's a current thing on that. I want to reiterate that AFN and the Alaska Natives are not here before the legislature asking for subsistence rights. We feel very strongly we have them, and we have strong protections under Title VIII of ANILCA, which, whether or not the Secretary of Interior, you know, has taken all his authority in those temporary regs or not, that we ultimately believe that he will come out with stronger regulations. If and in fact he doesn't do that, that a federal court will compel him to do, you know, his responsibility. And so on that grounds, we're not asking for your assistance in that ground. What we're trying to do and what we've been trying to do since January is help the state regain the ability to manage a unified fish and game management system to try to avert going into that avenue. And so what we have been working with the governor since right at the beginning of the case, since we have been with the state in that case, the McDowell case, since that's been in court since 1983, we've been on the same side with the state all the way since 83, is we made a decision, the Native people and all our organizations, that it was beneficial to the Native people in the state for the state to try to, you know, go after regaining its management authority. And our legal assessment of the options, it was very, very few options available if Alaskans want to make the decisions themselves in the state, and the constitutional amendment was the only option that we saw that Alaskans could do if they want to make the decisions themselves. We're very much in agreement with the governor and the entire congressional delegation in support of a constitutional amendment, and we were very pleased that Senator Stevens came and spoke before you today. Like I said, we share his views as far as the opening up ANILCA, the risks that there are out to the Alaska business community, the Alaska state as a whole. We feel very much that it would be a 3 to 5 year process if you went down the route of amending ANILCA. And I think that there's a lot of other national interests that would weigh into the discussion. We feel very strongly that the Native community will use every resource at its disposal to protect its rights, including protect Title VIII in ANILCA, if not try to change that to make it crystal clear Congress's intent, and therefore we do not welcome a path that goes down the route of trying to opening up ANILCA, because we fear that we will not be a unified state, because, you know, we'd have differing goals. Our goals would be to protect our people's interests and to ensure that the integrity of the Title VIII, which was enacted by the Congress to protect Alaska Native people basically, that in fact remains intact. Like I said, we do support the delegation and the governor in preferring a constitutional amendment. We've supported the bill that came out of the House Resources and eventually the House Judiciary, and we urge your strong consideration of a constitutional amendment as the very best high road option that's available to the legislature, should you want to choose that in the state. We very much are offended by ideas that, you know, having a ballot initiative out in front of the voters is a divisive issue. I think that that allows the people in the state to exercise their will, and you shouldn't be fearful of putting a proposal in front of them to consider. I do want to respond to one question that I understand was raised earlier, and that had to do with how Title VIII will be interpreted in the courts, and now that it has been challenged on that. I wanted to just make a few comments on that. Congressman Morris Udall was the original sponsor of Title VIII in Anilka, and at the time of passage, I'd like to quote a segment from him, as well as a couple of just briefly some components that fit in with that, to give you an understanding of what type of legal standard you know, the different parties would be up against as far as the Title VIII, and reiterate that, in fact, Title VIII has been held by the Ninth Circuit Court to be considered Indian legislation, and that has very significant ramifications for any challenge to that. Congressman Udall, when as the original sponsor, and I'll quote, stated, although the federal and state management of subsistence established in this bill is racially neutral, it is important to recognize that the primary beneficiaries of the subsistence title and other provisions in the bill relating to subsistence management are the Alaska Native people. Although there are many non-natives living a subsistence way of life in rural Alaska, which may be an important national value, the subsistence title would not be included in the bill if non-native subsistence activities were the primary focus of concern. Rather, the subsistence title and other subsistence provisions are included in recognition of the ongoing responsibility of the Congress protect the opportunity for continued subsistence uses in Alaska by Alaska Native people, a responsibility consistent with our well-recognized constitutional authority to manage Indian affairs. The same public purpose is reiterated in the opening text of Anilka, in which the Congress finds and declares that, quote, in order to fulfill the policies and purposes of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and as equity, it is necessary for the Congress to invoke its constitutional authority over Native affairs. Given this text, language, and legislative history, there is no doubt that Title VIII of Anilka is Indian legislation, exercised under the Congress's constitutional power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Indeed, in 1984, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals specifically held that Title VIII is Indian legislation, and that was in Hodel versus the Village of Gamble OCS case. And we think that this has enormous legal consequences that flow from this fact. First off, Congress's plenary power over Indian affairs will override constitutional objections raised against Title VIII. Second, the public purpose enumerated by Representative Udall, the chairman of the committee, like I said, the prime sponsor of the legislation on the House side, will continue to be an ongoing trust responsibility of the United States towards Alaska Natives, despite political pressures to the contrary. And third, any federal regulations which fail to protect the subsistence hunting and fishing rights of Alaska Natives will most likely be successfully challenged and overturned in federal court. And so for those that feel that the federal regs are benign, the Secretary of Interior will have to meet his obligations under Title VIII. In addition, his obligations in Title VIII being considered Indian legislation, which is with its enormous ramifications, as well as his trust, his special relationship between Alaska Natives and the federal government, which is similar to Native Americans across the nation. We feel very strongly that Alaska Native people's interests will be protected. We would prefer not to go through the court routes to do that, and because we view that the courts are very divisive, and we do not wish the judges, federal judges, to be controlling fish and game management in the state, no more than we would wish the Boston school system would have the federal judges controlling the education system in Boston, or any of the other areas in which, because people have failed to resolve it in the states, that people have had to rely upon the courts. However, I want to reiterate the Alaska Native community is very much united in the fact that subsistence is the number one issue of concern to them. It's a life and death type issue, and they will use everything at their disposal, economic or political, to ensure that the needs of their people are protected. And like I said, any effort to try to repeal Title VIII of ANILCA would be met with a very vigorous challenge by ourselves and the other Native people in the state, as well as the national Indian community. The effort to challenge it in federal court, like I already mentioned, we've indicated reluctantly we've had to file in that. We have urged the legislature to try to take their responsibility seriously and try to create the opportunity for them to get back in the decision-making loop and try to give themselves the authority. Our assessment of where the situation is the legislature is basically precluded from participating in the decision-making because of the Supreme Court justice's decision in this, and all we're asking for you to do is give yourselves the authority back, and the only way that you can get that is through a constitutional amendment which the voters approve, and so that's what we are asking for. And I'd like to ask John to make some comments on the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Shively. I'm the Senior Vice President of Nana Regional Corporation. I just want to sort of hit on one point because I think it's very important. You've been told by Mr. Ross and other people that really they are pro-subsistence, and they're just have a few little technical changes they need to take care of, and then they'll take care of the people in rural areas. I didn't hear everything he said here. To the Senate committee, he said that they were their brother's keepers. Mr. Starkey talked a little bit about the legal record and how the legal record did not support those comments. It is not only the legal record, it is the political record that does not support those comments. Mr. Ross and the people he represents have fought Native interests in the state since before the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed. If you go back and look at the record, you'll see some of the same names over and over again. These people will not rest until they have destroyed the Native culture. They do not want to see a separate Native culture. And for them to stand up here and tell you that, well, if we just get rid of this federal protection that the Natives got, well, then that's fine, we will take care of the people out in the bush, is just wrong. They have fought changes in the regulations. Many of their members are former members of the Fish and Game Department who actively fought subsistence laws in this state. The record is very clear on where they are. And I just want to make it clear to you so that you know when you come down on one side or the other where their feelings really are. It's not an easy decision. You know where we are, but I think it's real important to point out where those people really are. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kitka and Mr. Shively. Other questions? Representative Sharp.
Thank you. Just one. I don't know which one of you been with AFN the longest on through the ANILCA procedure, but I was wondering, did any of the legal advisors in the record that you just spoke of bring up the point during the crafting of this wording that it possibly would be in direct conflict with the state constitution at the time in 1980 and 1979 and so forth, and if so, the ramifications could possibly drive Alaskans into the arms of the federal regulatory agencies who, in some opinions, feel that their desires are in direct opposition to subsistence users.
I think I can answer that. I was in Washington for that. There was a disagreement, not particularly among our legal advisors, but among some people about whether or not the state constitution could support a rural preference. We believe that it could. The court, as you know, split 4-1 and found against us. That was discussed. We took what we thought was legitimate legal advice. We did at the time also know that that was not the end of the game for the state, however, that if the state constitution, for one reason or other, didn't support it, there was an opportunity for the state to amend the constitution. That is not time here tonight to go through the litany of how we arrived at needing the federal protection and the court's decisions and the kind of problems we have with people like the Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association over the years in getting some kind of subsistence protection, but there was a good reason for it. If you're comment is, were we concerned about the fact that we might ultimately drive the state into a federal management system and that there are federal people who wanted to manage, want now to manage the fish and game? We were aware of that, but we always felt that we would be with the state to keep the management in state hands, and that's still our intent.
Additional questions? No additional questions. Thank you, Ms. Kitke and Mr. Shively. Appreciate your comments. Finally, we come to Mr. Holmes. If you would, please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it on? I guess it's on.
Yeah,
I believe is if it? You...
Okay,
yes. Okay, you're on. I can't see which way.
I'm Larry Holmes, and I represent the Alaskan Bowhunters Association. We're made up of approximately 1,000, well, actually a little over 1,000 regular and sustaining members. We have membership throughout the state from Adak to Barrow and from Homer to Hyder. And we've got a few people out in the lower 48 and some people in Australia and Europe. And we primarily are dedicated to fostering, perpetuating fair chase hunting of the bow and arrow. We're a sporting group. However, we've been involved in regulatory affairs and some legislative affairs that have to do with fishing and hunting ever since we were became an organization. And with this issue, when this issue came up, our board took this to our membership in the form of a letter. And the response we got back is that overwhelmingly our board supports the subsistence use of fish and wildlife. We support the diverse and unique cultures that exist throughout the state. We don't have a problem with any group, individual, or family that has to take fish and game for food or for customary and traditional use to provide themselves with clothing. However, we recognize that the Constitution provides all of us with that opportunity if the need is there. And I had a presentation prepared earlier before the Senate Resources Committee, and I sat and listened through that, and you folks convened, and then I decided to come up here to listen, see what's going on. So I guess what I'm going to do now is provide you with a different approach to what I was originally going to do, because it seems like everybody's confused on this issue, and I thought I wasn't confused until I came in to these hearings, and I went through a period where I really didn't understand what everybody was, what the problem was. And now I really wonder what the problem is. That we have two issues here. One is a rural preference issue. It's not a subsistence issue. I don't know anybody, despite some testimony, I don't know anybody that does not support the subsistence use of fish and wildlife. It's the most fundamental right that we have, short of an equal right or equal access to a resource. It's the most fundamental, and everybody supports it. That is not the issue. The issues are rural preference and a constitutional amendment. And when we started the regular session in January, we had a rural preference problem. Coming out of the regular session, we had a rural preference problem, and we've got a constitutional issue. And I'm not going to address the rural preference problem because I'm not going to keep you here all evening. But I want to point some things out here. In Article 8, Section 3, it provides for equal opportunity and access to all resources by all Alaskans. In Section 4, it provides a preference. The managers of the Department of Fish and Game have said and are saying, and so has the chairman of the joint boards, they can provide for subsistence use of fish and wildlife under existing regulations. Under this constitution right here, I have in my possession a comment to Beverly Cutler's decision by the chairman of the joint boards. There's no problem with that. They don't have a problem with it. I don't understand what the issue is with a priority use for subsistence. And I don't understand why anyone would want to change this document that protects all of us from each other. The Eastern Bloc countries have overthrown the totalitarian regimes to gain equality and freedom for themselves. Nelson Mandela is visiting the United States right now to gain support, to gain equality and freedom for his people. Cultures and countries have been fighting for equality for centuries. And eventually they end up with something that provides everybody the opportunity for equal access and equal opportunity to resources. And this is what we've got. And I don't see how we can go round robin and come back where we started. The example we have, and we have an example right now, and I hate to open up another can of worms, but limited entry. 1972, we passed an amendment to provide for limited entry fishing permits. And since that time, we have seen those permits go outside, the revenues generated from those permits go outside, and the
Mr. Holmes, I would ask, please keep your comments germane to the
legislation to give you
before us, because it has been a long day. Thank you.
Clearly, we are in an emergency situation. This is a situation we can't define the parameters of, even at this point. There could be expenses that occur, and the whole purpose of this kind of fund would be to...
One better thought. Probably there is a reason to at least leave some balance there. You do need money there available in that response fund, and it is $1.6 million. And that amount changes from year to year. It's based on, as I understand it, claims and payments that go into that fund, and it's drawn down, goes back up. And right now it is $1.6 million. I would think we should leave it.
The amendment to provide for limited entry permits specifically changed Article 8, Section 3, and I'm saying that I don't feel that change has been demonstrated to be in the best interest of Alaskans. And I'm saying here we are about to revisit the same section of the same article, and I don't think that we're going to benefit from it. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes, for your comments. Are there questions by members of the committee? Representative Phillips.
Do you have an alternative?
Yes, I do. Right here. Section 4 provides for... And I'll read it.
Well, I know what it is.
Okay. But it provides for a preference for beneficial uses of fish and wildlife.
Okay, but the problem is we have a federal law.
Fish and Game, right. Fish and Game says they may use this under a Tier 2 plan, and it will work. That has nothing to do with the constitutionality, the federal constitutionality, or the federal problem that we have with the NELCA. We'll have to challenge the NELCA to change that. I don't see any other alternative, and I think that our federal delegation has come to that conclusion also.
Additional comments or questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Holmes. Are there any
final
comments by members of the committee or Representative Phillips?
No comments, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. We do have one more group. The Southeast Subsistence Commission is Mr. Willard. I don't see Mr. Willard.
Ma'am, are you?
Okay. The committee has shown great diligence, I believe, and I would like to thank all members of the committee for their hard work, their dedication, and their tenacity. It is the intent now of the co-chairman to conclude the public testimony portions of the legislation before us. Tomorrow we will be hearing from other representatives on their respective bills as regards this issue, and then we will go into amendments and discussions and debate of the committee or by the committee on the legislation before us. If there are no other comments, then our meeting is adjourned.
We're going to meet.
Yeah. We'll meet
after session. We'll be tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. I suspect what we'll do
what
is
time
we'll,
of session?
We'll have session, and then we'll
10 o'clock.
Right. And then we'll probably
fishing license thing. We're going to deal with that when we come back then on Monday.
I guess.
Okay. Senator Duncan.
On the letter of intent, I would hope that the legal people could help write that. I think it needs to be pursue the claims to get this money back.
We're going to need an immediate letter of intent on that so that we are making sure it's taken care of legally. Senator Zaroff.
Okay. Getting back to the fishing game, our fishing licenses, let me suggest to the sponsor there that if, since we are going to deal with it on Monday, that an effective date be added to there. If we're going to come back with a committee substitute, if you would add that, if you feel that it's important, if you put an effective date on it, I think it would take care of it.
Okay.
This season.
Okay. We've got the AG here right now. Why don't we go ahead and see if we can get the language worked out right now, maybe briefly. Could you work with Mike on that, and we could...
Hey, Mr. Chairman, basically what I understand you want on this is you want to pursue the reimbursement of the costs and in terms of expenses and use funds, your intent to spend the funds received from program receipts prior to the general fund to the extent possible.
These are your changes, John. These are the changes that we made out. We went with the 10 and the 10. Senator Binkley just got here.
So we're in effect, Mr. Chairman, we're going to leave about $10 million, even beyond when this is, this disaster is over, we're going to leave $10 million in the fund?
$2 million.
There's 1.6 now.
Okay. There, that way that it'll lapse with the exception of $2 million, so that there's always an emergency amount there in the case of another catastrophe.
Why did we go to January 31, 1990?
So some people want to go all the way till next year. And
yeah, but I thought we were going to have it lapse at the end of this fiscal year.
Well,
so they could deal with it in the budget.
There's concern by other people. That, you want to explain this?
The interim activities that may take place there that may... They may need the funding available. Yeah, but of course, we can deal with that in the budget. I mean, this is kind of an emergency appropriation that we're dealing with on an expedited basis. But, you know, things are unfolding rapidly. I mean, they'll know much more in a week than they do today, and they'll know far more in 2 weeks and even more than that in 3 weeks when we're actually completing our budget. And I thought that's why we had talked about doing it July 1, 1989, so that we could actually appropriate those monies in the regular budget act as it proceeds.
So there was a lot of discussion on it, and there was some concern that they may go through that money faster, and that we'd have to come back again, and so on and so forth.
Well, if they go through the money faster, we'll certainly know that before the end of the session. We can appropriate the money.
Senator Szymanski.
Well, I appreciate that. The concern that I have with putting in July 1 this year fiscal cutoff is we're sitting... 40 days away from you wrapping up the budget, and what you're going to tell me is in the next 30 days, you're going to anticipate what may happen three months from now, 4 months from now, and you're going to try to make an adjustment in the operating budget to accommodate that. I can't take that risk because we may be back in a special session to deal with it because we made an error in the next 30 days because this thing is just evolving, and I think it's just too high a risk to take.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the fact that you can't take the risk. The point is, Mr. Chairman, that this event happened 1 week ago today. We're talking about giving $10 million to the governor or to the administration through this fund. They don't give us any explanation on how they're going to spend one single penny of it. They don't have any idea, and that's understandable. This event happened 1 week ago. There's very little information out there on exactly what's going to need to be done, even knowing what money's been spent in the last week. That's understandable. But a week from now, we'll have a lot better information on what money we spent in the last 2 weeks, what the needs are going to be in the next 2 weeks. 2 weeks from then, we're going to have a lot more information beyond that. My point is that as this thing progresses, the more information comes in, the better understanding we have of the issue, better understanding we have of the scope of the problem, and whether this is adequate or not. And so that's why we put the July 1st, 89 lapse date on the original bill or on the committee substitute so that we had the opportunity then to look at it in the budget sessions in the next 40 days, as the Senator pointed out, to get better information on what the extent of this is, what the real needs are.
Senator Cotulla, did you want to add to that?
In my experience, Servanks Fund is one of them. Actually, We had special session, directed it and finished it and provided various direct benefits in a 3-day period. We went something on faith. You've got to expect good best bookkeeping out of the administration, so these are collectibles. The problem is, I think you better get a little longer period of time, and I think it's a January 1 period is probably a reasonable compromise to make certain that we aren't intact and have to come back in special session 1. 2, again, if you have July 1, and there is insecurity out there, I believe quite a bit of money will be put out there into the programs without sufficient background because they're going to be pressured in that time frame because they don't want to underestimate the need. They don't want to underdo what is necessary out there. They don't have that time frame. They will give the response a little more consideration, take a little more time to it, and I think you're going to lose some money, waste some money, if you have that much pressure on that time.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Binkley,
we're not in a special session.
When we went over this a few minutes ago.
I don't see the correlation between the Fairbanks flood of 67 when the legislature did come into special session and this disaster when we already are sitting in session working on the budget and we have another 40 days to deal with that budget. We do have the next 40 days to deal with this issue, to make appropriations to this response fund if this is not enough. In the regular budget course, that takes effect July 1 of 1989. So that, in effect, there is no gap at all, and that we just have better information the farther down the line we go. Next week, we're going to know a lot more than we do today. Why not take advantage of that?
Senator Catula, do you want to respond to that?
Well, the situation is this. You do have more information. You may wish to contribute something else. You may even have information that allow you to reduce this fund. But the facts are right now, I think if you give that limited time frame to it, you're making an error. I think you ought to get an extended time frame for this decision. You're putting it in the legislation. What you've got, what your big concern really is reimbursement and the proper distribution of funds, reimbursement available and it is to handle. That's real. And that you can plan on the money being back in the state coffers by the time that you have to have it available to fund the budget that you're concerned about. And I think that surely next January adequately does that.
Senators are off here. I guess I agree with Senator Catula, and if I were to agree with Senator Binkley, I think they're instead of having a lapse date of whatever it was, July
into the fiscal year.
Into this fiscal year, that we should have a lapse date then of May 1 this year, so that you deal with it in this legislature, and not have to come back during the interim. If you really need that shorter period of time to see what's going on, but I move it. Concur more with the January 31st date because it does give a little bit more flexibility. It doesn't force anybody into doing anything. But the June 30th of this year again puts it beyond the scope there of where the legislature can deal with it during the session without having to come back for a special session if it is indeed necessary to do that.
Mr. Chairman, you know, we're not trying to cause any interruption in the flow of these funds to be able to be expended. If we did have a lapse date of May 1st, there would be, between May 1st and the end of June, you wouldn't be able to spend any money. There wouldn't be any money available. What we're saying is have this appropriation lapse July 1 and this piece of legislation, which is a special piece of legislation on an emergency basis. The farther we go down the road in the next 2 weeks, we're going to have more information on how to deal with this, if this is adequate money, if it's not adequate money, if it's too much money, we'll have that information. We can deal with that then in the course of the budget to have the money available. Continue on with this right on through July 1st. And it just provides the continuity and still allows the legislature to review it then in the next couple of weeks as more information becomes available. And I don't see, it seems like the administration would welcome that ability.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe we were arguing. I understand what Senator Binkley is saying. It seems to make a lot of sense. I think we're arguing almost about a non-point, except if we're going to do that, we don't want July 1 date for lapsing. We want June 30th date for lapsing. Because the budget takes effect July 1, and the new appropriation to the Hazard Assistance Release Response Fund, if we were to include that in the budget, we'd be back immediately. So you don't want July 1 in there. You want June 30th.
Right.
So you would end up with no money in fiscal year 90 if we leave July 1 in there. It is possible, I guess, if we could appropriate the $10 million general fund, $10 million program receipts to the fund here, mm-hmm. would
lapse back June 30th, but we'd have to be sure we had money to replace that on July 1 in the operating budget.
Exactly.
So the lapse date's wrong if you're going to do that. It'd have to be
I don't know who drafted it, but it should be June 30th.
It should be June 30th, then, if you want to.
If you want to
that's
follow,
fine.
Follow that procedure. But that's going to mean, according to me, and that would mean they'd have the $20 million between now and June 30th, but there'd have to be a commitment on the legislature to be sure there was money there starting July 1 in the budget.
Exactly.
I don't know that it's all that, it's all that big of a deal as long as we're sure we're going to be sure there's money there July 1.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to pass it to lapse it back July 1, there's going to have to be zero there July 1.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan's point is well taken. It should actually read June 30th, 89. I don't know why it was drafted July 1, but that's a good point.
Whatever the pleasure of the committee is, we have to rescind our action in adopting the committee substitute. Senator Frank?
I'd like to get the administration.
Okay. Could you elaborate on exactly what you're going to expend between now and...
Just on the point of, does that cause a problem? If we were to do what Senator Bickley was saying.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, I guess I would have to concur with Senator Curtula. I'm concerned that that we're going to have ongoing expenses. And the kind of concern that he's talking about, people are going to have to make rush decisions in the field. They're going to have to be conservative in their making the decision and expend because they know they may lose the money 5 or 6 weeks down the line. And I think to allow a longer period of time to make a decision is going to make them make more legitimate and better decisions.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I haven't explained this clearly enough, or maybe the administration doesn't quite understand it. This does not restrict your ability to spend this money between now and July 1st. It doesn't mean that you can't spend money beyond July 1st. As long as money is appropriated in the course of the normal budget process. I mean, normally, that's the way you handle things. You have a need, you come in, you go through the normal budget process, it takes effect July 1, and away you go. Obviously, we can't deal with this particular issue like that because we need the money now, today, and between now and July 1st. So we can't wait until July 1st. So we're going to make a special appropriation that's good for you to expend between now and July 1st. The rest of it we can take care of in the normal budget process that becomes available July 1st. Doesn't restrict your ability to spend any money between now and that time. It just gives us the opportunity to review it more carefully between now and the end of session.
What do you think, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, about 10 minutes, 5 minutes? Yes, go ahead, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Binkley, I understand what you want to accomplish. I'm just concerned that you won't accomplish that. I think Senator Curtula's point is well taken, that people are going to feel under pressure. You've been indicating that we're going to know a lot more a week from now and a lot more 2 weeks from now. I don't think anybody has the slightest idea how much we're going to know a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. We may not know in sufficient detail to be able to respond a month from now, 2 months from now, 3 months from now.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Binkley.
Do you think we'll know more a week from now than we do today?
I hope so. I would hope so.
Yeah, I would hope so. I'd hope we know more tomorrow about the issue. It's an evolving issue, and we know more as it progresses. You know, can you give me an example of an instance where somebody is going to be under pressure as a result of this effective date to make a different decision that they would than they would if it were January 31st of 1990?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Binkley, it occurs to me that if one were to, they wanted to close off an inlet, they may decide that there's a heavy sea going booms and there's a lighter boom.
Mm-hmm.
They may make a decision that they need to expand, in order to preserve that inlet, mm-hmm. they're going to expend as much money as they possibly could at that moment,
mm-hmm.
Rather than make a more calculated decision at that moment, make a decision which would expend greater resources because they might not know after July 1 whether there was going to be any money available to do that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that's nonsense. You know, the legislature, if this event is occurring in June 15th and the individual is trying to make a decision as to whether or not to purchase a more expensive boom or a less expensive boom. He already knows what money has been appropriated to the fund. It may indeed be that there's $20 million there of general fund dollars rather than 10. And he has that assurance. And not just until January 31st, but until the end of that fiscal year, which is June 30th of 1990.
Senator Duncan, we can continue this on. We sort of had the consensus that we were going to go with the 31st of January and leave it at that, unless they want it. You want to go back and change it.
Well, I would be more than adopted.
How do the other members feel about it?
I mean, maybe one other side. I'm just wondering, maybe if I could ask the governor's office, maybe having the earlier, on this appropriation, the earlier lapse date, would that perhaps, it might add some pressure, but it might add pressure on the side of people going out and being sure they're collecting the money from the responsible party.
That's true.
And so it's a good point.
We don't get complacent about
right.
collecting on our claims. Maybe it would encourage individuals and the state to be sure we're collecting those claims as quickly as possible to help pay for some of these costs.
Do you want to respond to that, please, from the administration?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, I have every confidence the Department of Law is going to pursue the claims on behalf of the state aggressively, forthrightly. I have little, no question whatsoever that the Department of Law is going to act in a firmly and aggressive way and manner in this situation.
What Senator Fisher, Senator Pierce, Senator Frank, you have any comments on changing the lapse date back to the 30th of June? Senator Fisher.
I don't have a comment other than maybe this might put Senator Binkley's mind at ease. Under existing law, the commissioner shall give us a report on this fund no later than the 10th day following the convening of each regular session. Did we get that report this year? And if we did, then maybe. Does anybody know if we did? I mean,
I don't think we actually did.
Oh, I thought that would be good backup to show that things do happen the way the law says they should have. And I don't know whether we got that report on the fund status or not. So we're just checking to see.
Senator Frank?
Did maybe.
Well, that's a good point. Perhaps that would suggest that the January 31st date would be the more appropriate date, so that we could take a look at the report and see what the needs were, give some assurances, to the administration that the money will be there. I'm not sure why. My biggest concern, frankly, is that the final or Section 3 is contained there. That the money isn't just going to sit there forever. The money, in fact, will be transferred. Any excess will be transferred to the general fund at some date. And I can certainly see that we aren't going to know the full extent, nor are we going to have expended all the money necessary by the end of this fiscal year. But by the end of the next fiscal year, or maybe by next January, we will. I would suspect most of the work gets. I hope most of it gets done this year, but we'd be able to assess it later at that time.
I'm sure that this can be talked about later on. Senator Fisher, do you want to make a comment? I will support the co-chairman's motion. If he wants to make a motion to change it to June 30th. Senator Fisher.
No, I'm just saying what's the procedure. You have to rescind.
We have to rescind our document.
Well, couldn't we just amend it once we adopted it, or have we already adopted it?
It's gone.
It's already been
gone.
We have to rescind it. I think it came in later. It's gone.
We did miss the action.
You have to rescind your action.
We missed the action.
It's like I'm sitting right here.
Yeah. So we need a motion to rescind our previous action. Senator Binkley, do you want to make that motion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd move and ask you to rescind our action in adopting Senate Bill number 247 for the purpose of the specific amendment that we've discussed.
And
ask
for
unanimous consent.
In passing it out.
In passing it out.
Is there any objection to that? It's now back before us.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that Section 3, Line 21, the dates January 1st, 1990, be changed to June 30th, 1989. Nine, and ask for unanimous consent.
Is there objection to that? If there's no objection, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that we move out committee substitute consent bill number 247, amended to finance, with individual recommendations.
Is there an objection? So ordered. Senator Duncan has an accompanying letter of intent.
Mr. Chairman, there's a letter of intent before you. I want to read it because there is one recommended change by the Department of Law, which I think is a good change. The letter of intent would be the Department of Law will pursue the recovery of all the law costs incurred in responding to the Valdez Exile Health Bill, and that every attempt will be made to expend program receipts received from Exxon or other sources prior to the expenditure of general fund appropriations.
Is there any objection to that letter of intent? Letter of intent is adopted and passed out. Is there anything else to come before the Finance Committee? The Finance Committee is adjourned.